From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Air Talk. Good morning, I'm Larry Mantle. The state legislature is moving a bill banning the knowing distribution of deceptive video or audio of a political candidate, but also allow those candidates who claim they're victims of so-called deep fakes to sue. Proponents claim it'll discourage doctored and misleading content, but is it constitutional? We'll take it on right after the news.
We're entering an era in which our enemies can make it look like anyone is saying anything at any point in time, even if they would never say those things. So, for instance, they could have me say things like, Killmonger was right, or Ben Carson is in the sunken place, or, how about this, simply, President Trump is a total and complete Now, you see, I would never say these things, at least not in a public address, but someone else would. Someone like Jordan Peele.
That's a PSA on so-called deep fake videos made by comedian and film director Jordan Peele and BuzzFeed's Jonah Peretti. The fake video featuring a fake President Obama talking and sounding like himself somewhat with things, as he said, he would never say. Good morning. It's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Good to have you with us. We're going to talk about a bill in Sacramento that attempts to address so-called deep fakes during the 2 months right in front of an election. Coming up later this hour, we're going to talk about a bill that would also legalize sports betting in California. Last year, the U.S. Supreme Court opened the door for states to legalize, but here there's some complicating factors like the significant revenues and business interests of tribal casinos. So we'll look at the bill's prospects later this hour. But first, the bill that attempts to deal with what's said is to be the knowing distribution of doctored videos and audio recordings of political candidates. But who determines the intent to deceive during an election? And might that ban run afoul of constitutional protections for political speech? Joining us is Matthew Scherer, attorney and legal scholar with the firm Littler Mendelsohn in Portland. He writes on the intersection of law and artificial intelligence, and he edits the blog Law and AI. Mr. Scherer, good to have you with us today. Talk a little bit about the technology available now to create what can be very convincing fake video and audio recordings.
So the technology that makes deepfakes possible is a flavor of artificial intelligence called deep learning. And without going into too much detail, deep learning is a type of machine learning, which is itself a kind of subclass of AI, that involves artificial neural networks, which are inspired by the way that human neurons are thought to interact with each other. And using some very complicated statistical and mathematical techniques and using this structure of an artificial neural network, it allows the AI system, or however you want to describe it, to look for patterns at a much deeper level and at a much more complicated level than previous generations of technologies did. And that's why you can see image recognition software, for instance, that has improved so much in the past few years. And one kind of rather new aspect of deep learning that we're seeing more is called generative deep learning. And as the term generative suggests, that means that you can use deep learning to generate things rather than simply to analyze things. And deepfakes is kind of, by far, I think, the most disturbing kind of application of deep learning that we've seen in the past few years. And really, it's come of age just in the past 6 months to 1 year.
Wow. And so this goes well beyond superimposing someone's head on someone else's body, or just taking the words of previous speeches and switching the orders up on that to create a fake speech, for example, for a political candidate. This goes to a much deeper level, it sounds like.
Yes, yes, and no pun intended, I'm guessing, on the word deeper. That's exactly right. It goes to basically you can almost from scratch, and by that I mean just using images or existing videos of a person speaking, you can use these deep learning techniques in order to kind of reconstruct that person's speech and then have them give them a new kind of script to read, if you want to call it that, where they're saying something completely different than anything that they're saying in the videos that are available of that person, but the machine has picked up on enough of the way the person sounds, the way the person looks, and how their mouth moves when they talk to produce a pretty reasonable fake of that person saying whatever the person who is making this deep fake wants it to appear that they're saying.
Have you learned of any efforts to try and control deep fakes by making them illegal, by banning them, by allowing suing for damages? Or is this California bill the first to try and do that?
The California bill is certainly the first high-profile effort to do that. As I kind of indicated, deep fakes, really we started to hear about them for the first time probably only within the past 3 years or so. And it's only really been in the past year that the technology has progressed so rapidly that it's no longer really a hypothetical threat. It's something that, you know, realistically could be used to undermine our faith in democracy and in news media. So I really think that it's only in the past few months that we're seeing kind of a more concerted effort to look at it. And the California bill is by far, I think, the highest profile example of that.
And what do you think of the constitutionality of this? Because I understand it's a pretty high bar for what you have to cross. If you're saying something about a public figure generally, and of course a political candidate is a public figure, so do you have any concerns that this kind of opening up the door for civil action against someone who knowingly distributes a deep fake, that this could run afoul of the First Amendment?
There definitely are First Amendment limits to how much you can regulate speech, and the bar is even higher when you are talking about a public figure, as you just indicated. So, you know, I would kind of compare it to, let's say that somebody from, you know, NPR ran a story where they included a fake quote from a person. Well, including the fake quote is not in and of itself, you know, something that is protected by the First Amendment. But if it's not really a fake quote, if it's just kind of a mischaracterization of what the person said, then it becomes a lot blurrier whether that's defamation to a degree that it can be regulated and you can have a cause of action against them for it. Or is it just kind of a form of political speech and analysis? And the same thing, I think that the idea of, again, including a fake quote in a newspaper or some sort of news broadcast, that's the close analogy. If it really was done with a malicious intent to make it appear that the public figure had said something that they are not, and there's, you know, little or no factual basis for it, then it, you know, it would probably not be covered by the First Amendment. If, on the other hand, again, it was just a paraphrase of what the person was said, satire, or if there was some justification for it that would bring it outside the bounds of defamation law, then it would, at that point, be protected by the First Amendment.
Matthew,
closer and closer to being protected the more the person is a public figure.
Matthew Scherer with us. He's a legal scholar and attorney based in Portland, Oregon. He's editor of the blog Law and AI, and we're talking about a bill in Sacramento that's already passed the state assembly, and it's going on to the Senate Elections Committee. What it would do is, within 2 months of an election, provide the ability of a voter or a candidate to sue if someone has knowingly distributed a so-called deep fake, something that is intentionally altered, a video or an audio recording, to with the intent to damage the candidate during her or his run for office. Also with us, UCLA law professor Eugene Volokh. He is a specialist, among other areas of law, on speech protections. Professor Volokh, we appreciate your joining us. Do you think that this bill is constitutional?
It's hard to tell. Surprisingly, perhaps, the Supreme Court has never decided whether bans on knowing or reckless falsehoods that are aimed at affecting election campaigns, whether those bans are constitutional. There's a good argument that they are constitutional on the theory that knowing lies, false statements of fact, are less valuable than other speech and therefore more restrictable. But there's a good argument that they're unconstitutional as well. The Supreme Court has rejected the view that lies categorically lack First Amendment value, and some courts have struck down broader, to be sure, statutes banning knowing lies in election campaigns, in part on the grounds that when it comes to especially lies about politics, the legal system is particularly likely to do a bad job of figuring out who's telling the truth and who's not. What they were thinking at the time they said it and the like. Ultimately, these decisions about what's true and what's a lie are made by people, maybe people who are we call judges, but they're people who could have the same kinds of political passions that the rest of us have. So as a result, turning this into a judicial process may lead to quite inaccurate and partisan results. From the court.
Let me use an extreme example, sort of the best I can come up with top of mind. Let's say one candidate or the campaign of a candidate accuses another candidate of having arrived from another planet and is a space alien, an extraterrestrial, and so this is a claim that's made about another candidate. Under current law, can that candidate accused of being an extraterrestrial go into court and seek injunctive release that, you know, this is clearly a lie and meant to defame him? Is that sort of outlandish speech protected or not?
So I think you might imagine a libel lawsuit, and some states, including California, do allow, following a full trial, do allow, and a jury trial at that, injunctions in libel cases. I will say that that kind of allegation is just so outlandish that I don't think we need the courts to try to correct that. I think that by and large, voters are going to realize that this is a lie. And then on top of that, if it is a rival candidate that's spreading this, this is going to redound against the rival candidate. If voters hear candidate A saying this about candidate B, they're going to think worse about candidate A, not about B, precisely because they're spreading such nonsense.
But who determines what's a nonsensical claim versus something that's an out-and-out intentional lie to do political harm?
So in the example that you gave, the answer would be the voters. That the voters would pretty quickly solve this problem. Our problem here is not about the outlandish claims. Our problem, practically speaking, is about claims that are plausible, that at least that some voters, a considerable number of voters, will say, maybe there's something to that. And those are also, many of those claims are the ones where we might think judges aren't going to do a great job of resolving whether they're true or false, especially in a hurried manner. This bill, for example, calls for this to be decided in an accelerated way and for any such claim to take precedence over other claims. So as I said, as a First Amendment matter, it's unsettled. There is also some practical complication here. So one thing that the bill does is it allows any registered voter to ask for an injunction. So that means that if some voters who are either deliberately trying to play political dirty tricks or are just crazy, if they think that something which is perfectly accurate is actually faked, they could file hundreds of lawsuits, each one of which is going to take precedence over other claims. And all of those would have to be decided, presumably, within the 2 months before the campaign. So I think this bill is, at the very least, a little too aggressive in this respect.
We're talking with UCLA law professor Eugene Volokh. I'd like to hear from you what you think about this bill, which would ban so-called deep fakes or in knowingly distributing what are falsified videos or audio recordings of political candidates within 60 days of an election. As Professor Volokh just said, it would allow for a registered voter or for someone from the candidate's campaign, the candidate who's being targeted by the phony video or audio recording, to go to court and immediately seek injunctive or financial settlement of this. We're at 866-893-KPCC or the AirTalk page, kpcc.org. We'll continue in just 1 minute. Pleasure to have you with us today on AirTalk. I'm Larry Mantle. Coming up later this hour, a bill to legalize sports betting in California. Yes, of course, a lot of sports betting goes on here, but this would legalize it, regulate it in California. But it's not a simple matter. The tribal casinos have some concerns about this. Racetracks, of course, might be parties that, you know, they're going through their own challenges anyway, but might be affected by it. So we'll talk about the future of sports gambling and whether there is a future for it here in California. But right now we're talking about another bill already passed the Assembly. It's moved on to the Senate Elections Committee. And what it would do is, within 2 months of an election, ban the knowing distribution of faked video or audio recordings depicting a candidate in that election. What do you think about that? Do you think that this would be a good law to have it enacted, or do you have concerns, some of which have been expressed by UCLA law professor Eugene Volokh, that this could be used strategically by political opponents, that also it's unsettled law when it comes to the issue of the First Amendment and this kind of political targeted message? 866-893-5722 or the AirTalk page, kpcc.org. Leopold in Burbank wonders whether satirical or photoshopped humorous images would at all be affected by this. Matthew Scherer, attorney based in Portland, do you think this would have any effect on that?
Yes, I think that if it is satirical, number one, you can argue that at that point it's not really malicious, because certainly if it's clearly satirical or if it is marked as such, then number one, it likely is protected by the First Amendment just in and of itself. Satire is, in most circumstances, even when you're not dealing with a particularly public figure, a form of protected speech. When you are talking about the political use of satire, that seems to be really going at the core of the sort of speech that the First Amendment is designed to protect. So I would think that that particular application of the California bill would be unlikely to hold up, and I'll be interested to see if Professor Volokh agrees on that.
Eugene, what do you think?
Well, so the text of the bill is limited to deceptive audio or visual media, which are images that are manipulated in such a manner that it would falsely appear to a reasonable observer to be an authentic record. Satire would generally not be covered, because satire, the reasonable observer would recognize, oh, this isn't really an authentic record, it's a joke. The difficulty is something that somebody says, oh, that's just really deadpan satire. And somebody else says, no, that actually is something that a reasonable person wouldn't perceive as satirical, but would perceive as accurate, even though it's inaccurate. Now, to be sure, that's a question that comes up already in claims, for example, like libel lawsuits. that if I publish something satirical about you, and then one question is, would a reasonable person really indeed perceive this as satirical, or would they totally miss the joke and assume that it's straight up accusation? This isn't a new issue, and I think in principle, at least, this law probably would be applied to sensibly sort the two. But at the same time, again, remember, this is going to be decided very quickly, within 2 months of an election, when everybody's political passions are up, including probably the judge's political passions.
good point.
It's not much with what happens if the law is properly applied. It's what happens if the law is misapplied by, after all, what's a human institution, the court system.
Gavin in Long Beach, what do you think about the bill?
Thank you. I had an example that I wanted to draw about this free speech conundrum. If someone is making a deep fake, and in the example of Obama's speech, I'm not sure I see the claim that it is a free speech, because if they're promoting it as Obama's speech, Obama never said those words, Obama can't claim the words, it's not his speech, posted anonymously or not, it's not their speech because they're making it Obama's speech. So it's not protected speech. It's limbo speech.
All right. Professor Volokh, what do you think of how Gavin is framing that?
No, I don't think that's quite right. If you create a video or create text, imagine, just forget about all of the technology. Think about documents. Think about things on paper, which, in fact, historically, there's been a long tradition of political forgery around elections. Whether you look at the Rathergate faked memos about President Bush before the 2004 election, there was an incident apparently in 1880 where there was a letter supposedly written by President Garfield. This is a potentially serious problem. I agree that it may be restrictable, but it is speech when somebody creates text, whether that is in their voice or in somebody else's voice.
All right. Gershon tweets
right. Does it often.
Yeah, Gershon tweets at AirTalk, your able legal experts are begging the big question, which is technological advances are outstripping law's ability to regulate them by shoehorning legislation into existing libel law and First Amendment doctrines. So do we need new approaches? Gershon, I mean, the Constitution exists nonetheless. Matthew Scherer, what do you think of Gershon saying essentially, you know, that the Constitution just isn't equipped to deal with this?
Well, I think that both the Constitution and in kind of interestingly, this particular bill doesn't really come to terms. Obviously, the Constitution was written 200 plus years before artificial intelligence in any form that we would consider artificial intelligence today came along. So, of course, that was not written with these things in mind. And but really what I think is very interesting is the bill itself, to a certain degree, does not really appear to have a good understanding. It's a little bit ambiguous on what sorts of deep fakes might be covered by it. And the reason I say that is that it defines deceptive audio or visual media as an audio or visual recording that has been intentionally manipulated in a manner that it would, you know, falsely appear to a reasonable observer to be an authentic record of the actual speech. The issue is that, as I kind of indicated earlier, really with the sorts of deep learning techniques that are used to create deep fakes, you can argue that they're not really manipulating an image. They are completely generating from scratch to a certain degree an image. You're not going to be able, just the way that the technology works, if you're feeding multiple different videos and images of a person talking into the system, you're not manipulating that particular, there's no particular video or image that you are manipulating. You are instead taking videos and images that may be coming from a variety of different speeches by a candidate, or maybe even a variety of speeches that include other people that have spoken on similar topics, and that for whatever reason, the person who is putting together the deep fake wants to be taken into account when they're designing this deep fake. So really, you know, the technology has moved past the point that even legislatures that are writing these bills today To me, they're not really using the language that accurately describes the way that the technology works.
They should have asked you about it first. Alex in Silver Lake, you're on Air Talk.
Yeah, I just wanted to say that I think that your guest is overestimating the American electorate's ability to discern malicious misinformation. And we saw in the 2016 election, for example, like images of Hillary Clinton hugging the late Senator Robert Byrd. And then that was used as evidence that she supports the KKK. And I would think that that's certainly considered outlandish. But that misinformation spreads and it compounds in on itself and people believe it. And then to go through and disprove each fake allegation or story becomes so cumbersome on the American electorate, it becomes almost impossible to discern fact from fiction. So for protecting our elections, we've got to consider these kinds of deep fake videos as being certainly defamatory, because the standard elaborated by the First Amendment is it actual malice. And this is clearly intended to hurt candidates and maybe even the broader electorate at large. And so we need to take a big, bold stance against these kinds of misinformation tactics, or else we're in big trouble as a democracy.
Alex, appreciate your call. Professor Volokh.
You know, I'm not quite sure about the Byrd analogy. Byrd had been apparently a member of the KKK, although I think he changed his views. I think this just highlights that this is not a new problem. People have been lying in elections for a long time. They've been forging documents for a long time. So I don't think that somehow the First Amendment needs to be revised in light of technology. The question is, as a practical matter, what's the best way of dealing with this that's also constitutionally permissible? I do agree there's at least a good argument that under the First Amendment, deliberate lies, whether in the form of deepfakes or otherwise, can lead to libel lawsuits and can lead possibly to other remedies as well. The question is, as a practical matter, are we likely to be able to have these kinds of super fast decision-making processes during the 2 months before an election, as opposed to the much longer libel trial, which usually comes before a jury after extensive discovery and the like. So I think there's possibly some room for, as a constitutional matter, for these kinds of restrictions. But as a practical matter, how much confidence do we have in the judiciary, which is staffed with people who are appointed by Democrats or Republicans and who have their own political passions, even if most of them try to tamp them down? As a practical matter, how good a job are they going to do in making these decisions very quickly, a couple of months before the election?
I want to thank you both so much for being with us and talking about this bill in Sacramento, which would allow legal action against someone knowingly distributing a doctored audio or video recording with the intent of influencing an election within 60 days of voting. Eugene Volokh, UCLA law professor. Matthew Scherer, attorney and legal scholar from Portland, who's editor of the blog Law and AI. Coming up on Air Talk, we talk about another state bill, this one which would legalize sports betting in California. The U.S. Supreme Court opened the door for states to do that last year. We'll hear the pros and cons of the bill right after a live update from Julie Slater. Great to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. There are a couple of different ways that initiatives can get on the ballot, you know, ballot propositions that are numbered. They can either come through the initiative process gathering signatures, but the legislature can also put them on the ballot. That's what's being contemplated in Sacramento right now, where lawmakers have proposed a ballot measure that would legalize sports betting in the Golden State. This follows last year's U.S. Supreme Court ruling, which opened the door for states to adopt legalized sports betting. Now, obviously, millions of dollars are bet on sports activity by Californians. The majority of that is done under the table. There's a lot of California dollars that are also spent at Las Vegas casinos, which accept bets on sporting activities. The question is, would it be in the state's best interest to legalize sports gambling here? Joining us is Jennifer Roberts, Associate Director of UNLV's International Center for Gaming Regulation. She's also adjunct professor of law at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. Professor Roberts, thank you very much for being with us. We appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. Good morning.
Good morning. So we've seen some states, is it New Jersey that's already gone this route? What kind of an effect do you think there would be if California legalized sports gambling?
Well, it depends on how they legalize it. Is it going to be offered through the lottery? Is it going to be offered through a gaming commission or a new control agency? And how does that affect tribal gaming and card rooms? So there are a lot of issues that this proposed constitutional amendment does not address, and that we would have to wait to see how it plays out.
What are some of the things, the ways that other states are contemplating providing legalized and regulated sports gambling?
Yeah, majority of states so far have offered it through their gaming commission, meaning it's controlled by the gaming commission, which oversees casinos and sometimes racetracks. And so they control it by allowing private operators, casino operators, to just add sports betting as one of their gambling amenities. And then the regulators regulate the private operators. A few states have tried or have legalized to allow through operations through the lottery, and that's a little unique when it comes to a form of gambling that's been historically found in the casinos, at least in Nevada, where we were the only state that had sports betting.
And so that means you'd have the public entity that would be handling the bets, or would this be some kind of public-private partnership or a private entity that's just publicly regulated, as in Nevada?
So it depends on how you structure it. So most that are offering it through the lottery will actually have the risk management and the operational, the operations actually handled by a private party. But the revenue goes directly to the state because it's a state-run agency that collects the revenues through this third party. But a gambling commission just simply oversees the licensing and operations and enforcement and audit of a private operator that then reports the revenue and pays taxes to the state.
Do you think that legalized California sports betting would have a significant impact on Nevada's casino-based sports gaming?
Well, I mean, it might have an impact in that, Californians do travel to Las Vegas to for entertainment, for visitation. But what we've seen is through studies that people actually don't come to Las Vegas primarily just to gamble. So maybe 5% come to Las Vegas just to gamble, and even fewer of those come just for the purpose of sports betting. So for the most part, just like anywhere else in the United States, sports betting has been, thriving in an illegal market. It's easy to access through apps and, internet and local bookies. So you don't really have to travel very far to have access to sports betting. So I don't see that it would have a significant impact. I think what we're going to see is how this plays out because, tribal governments also have the ability to offer gambling, and so that might conflict with what they're able to offer within their casinos and, how that impacts their compacts with the state.
We're talking with UNLV adjunct professor of law Jennifer Roberts. She's associate director of the International Center for Gaming Regulation. How profitable is legal sports betting in Nevada? What's the hold percentage or the take that casinos get?
It's really small, and that's where I think any state or tribe or any government that is looking at sports betting really needs to understand that, although the numbers, the amount that's wagered always seems like a very large amount. You hear about the billions of dollars that are being wagered in New Jersey and Nevada. But if you look at what is captured after paying out on winning wagers, the average hold, at least in Nevada historically, has been 5% on sports betting. Compare that to the average hold on blackjack at 12% or roulette at 18%. It's a very small number that is being captured by the operators and taxed. And so that is kind of the misnomer that people don't understand about sports betting. It's just a really a low hold percentage game, and it's not going to equate to the revenues that will resolve budget deficits and, you know, pension plan deficits and building bridges and new schools. That's the kind of misunderstanding that sports betting often carries.
And I didn't realize it made up such a small percentage of overall gaming revenue in Nevada, that at tops it's like 2.5%.
Yeah, it averages between 1 to 2.5% over the last, 20 years. So it's really a small percentage of our overall gaming revenues.
Jennifer Roberts of UNLV with us, also chairman of the California Nation's Indian Gaming Association, a nonprofit which advocates for tribal casinos and for sovereign rights of Indian tribes. Steve Stallings. Mr. Stallings, thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Larry.
So what is the potential role for tribal casinos in sports betting if it is legalized here?
Well, in California, there are 65 tribal casinos. We're really the dominant part of the gambling industry in California, even though there are about 80 card rooms in the state. And, any other state that was going to move forward with a regulated game and industry would be consulting with those people in the industry. And I think that's the failure of the current initiative by the legislature to move forward with a constitutional amendment without conducting any hearings whatsoever about this particular aspect of our industry. Jennifer's right. This is a very low margin business. The regulation of the of business is critically important. You think that those things would be flushed out before the legislature would move forward with a constitutional amendment in California. Our regulatory agencies in California were just audited, and a scathing report by the state auditor says that the state agencies have failed to do enforcement actions in the state. Their backlog in licensing, they're robbing Peter to pay Paul. So in that environment, it's kind of like a problem looking for a solution that doesn't exist. Yes, there is illegal sports betting, but it's not as though every day, people are being arrested or people are somehow, being affected by this. Our concern is that any expansion of gaming in California needs to have a thorough, thoughtful process, involve stakeholders in the industry. That includes both the tribes, the card rooms, and the racetracks in California, and even the lottery. This is a low margin business. Mm-hmm. It has, some public policy issues about, youth sports and youth getting access to sports betting. None of those things are fleshed out. And here we have a legislature that's trying to move forward in legalizing sports betting that, it's kind of like their latest failure to raise revenue in the state, and that's marijuana.
Well,
I hear from the state legislature all the time that their licensing of marijuana in California has failed to give them the tax revenues they need.
I wonder if this might be helpful, though, to broadening the customer base of tribal casinos, because my sense, and you can correct me if I'm off base, is that sort of the core clientele of the tribal casinos are middle-aged and older, probably female dominant demographically. If you're able to offer sports gaming, I know the margin is small, but wouldn't that potentially get more men into the casinos and perhaps younger bettors who would come in to place bets on sporting events and then decide to play blackjack?
Well, you're making an assumption that this industry would only exist inside brick and mortar casino facilities. And that hasn't been decided yet. What if sports betting in California is online? That doesn't encourage visitation. So these are the kinds of questions that need to be asked and answered prior to moving forward on an initiative, to legalize this in this state. The vast majority of revenue in sports betting in Las Vegas is on those major sports events like the Super Bowl, like the Final Four. That's when most of the generation of the profits are done in Las Vegas, because it does draw visitation and you do events around those major sporting activities. None of that has been thought out in this state yet, and it's like the cart before the horse.
We're talking with Steve Stallings. He chairs the California Nation's Indian Gaming Association. It's an organization that advocates on behalf of tribal casinos as well as the sovereign rights of Indian tribes overall. We're going to be talking with University of North Dakota professor who also specializes on tribal gaming, what the effects might be if California moves forward with a ballot measure that would allow voters to consider legalizing sports betting here in the Golden State. We're also taking your calls. What do you think about this? And if it were to be legalized, in what form do you think it should be legalized? 866-893-KPECC, the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Back in just 1 minute. Beryl tweets at AirTalk, I live in L.A. I sports bet online, no problem, mostly on the UFC. I would love if it was legal. The site I use is untrustworthy and might give me heck if my bit bets pay out. So I'm worried. Would be nice, like everything else, if it were legal. That's Beryl tweeting at AirTalk. We always welcome your tweets at AirTalk. You can also post on the AirTalk Facebook page or post on our AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Under consideration right now, a measure in Sacramento which would place on the ballot a proposition enabling Californians to vote on whether they want to legalize sports betting. Then the question would be, if Californians want to do so, in what form would it take? We've heard some of the options described by UNLV adjunct professor of law Jennifer Roberts. Steve Stallings has provided the tribal perspective from the California Nation's Indian Gaming Association. Also with us from the University of North Dakota, political science professor and co-director of the Institute for the Study of Tribal Gaming Law and Policy, Stephen Andrew Light. Professor, welcome.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Are these issues about tribal casinos and gaming revenues, are they playing out in pretty much all the other states considering legalizing sports betting?
I think that Jennifer and Steve have both given great background in terms of the broad landscape. What's happening right now is it's really moving very quickly, and I think what California is seeking to do is to catch up with what's happening across the U.S. States are legalizing sports gambling very rapidly. You have nine or so states that have legalized it. To date, only four tribes have legalized sports betting. And so the question of what happens next is key.
Do you see the tribal casinos suffering harm if sports betting is legalized and they're not involved in it?
Well, there's multiple dimensions to that question. So the tribal involvement, as far as the political process goes, makes complete sense as a core stakeholder in California, or set of stakeholders for tribes and tribal officials to be involved in deciding what comes next. The commercial operators in the state of California and elsewhere, and those who would do business with tribal casinos and other casinos, they're going to want to be involved as well. And then, of course, the question of how best to have state law changed, that's critical. So, you know, a ballot initiative is one thing where state voters get to be involved. State voters well outweigh, in terms of numbers, the number of tribal folks. So, on the other hand, if state officials decide this on their own as to put it on as a ballot measure, then you have the question of, should state legislators be the ones who are deciding this outcome for tribes? But ultimately, in the background, what's core is, in the state of California, there are existing Class 3 tribal-state compacts. Those compacts govern how gaming is regulated in California, and this would fundamentally change that equation.
But if you're talking about a totally different form of gaming, sports betting, then why would the compacts and the regulations for the operation of tribal casinos be relevant to that?
As of now, sports betting is considered to be what's called a Class 3 game under the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act, or the federal law that governs Indian gaming, along with tribal ordinances and tribal law and state law. So sports betting is classified as a Class 3 game by the National Indian Gaming Commission and its regulations. As a Class 3 game, all Class 3 games are governed and regulated under tribal-state compacts. So that's why this would change that playing field.
Even if it's not legal at the time the compact is, that's so interesting that it would extend to that. And so if the state decides it wants to set up a specific regulatory framework to handle sports betting, would legally the tribes have a firm standing to say we need to sign off on that and approve it?
Generally speaking, for Class 3 gaming, what you start with is whatever is legal under state law, tribes would theoretically have the ability to offer those same games or same types of games. And that's from there, that's where the ballot initiative or the state constitution or state law are key. From there, layered under that is a tribal-state compact and the federal enforcement of that compact. So in essence, both of those parts of the equation are important. Both are complicated. And that issue, coming back to the politics of it, the issue of how and when and whether tribes are involved in the conversations about this policy change, that's why that's so important, because the playing field changes with the introduction of a new type of game, a new type of Class 3 game.
Dove in Beverly Hills says, I bet online the money, I imagine, is routed through Asia. It makes me nervous. So if it was regulated, that would be great. So that's a couple listener comments, people saying that they gamble, they bet on sports, but they do it through websites. They do it despite it being illegal in California to place sports bets. And this gets back to UNLV adjunct law professor Jennifer Roberts, your point that there probably would be a strong customer base for this because of a legal, regulated California market where people wouldn't have to worry about, you know, perhaps not getting their payout or losing their money.
Yeah, that's the benefit of having a legal, regulated market. It offers transparency. It offers, you know, suitability restrictions on who can operate. We audit to make sure that there's a fair amount of revenues being paid to the state. So there are processes in place, including protection of consumer funds and patron dispute process, where, you know, if someone believes that they made one type of wager, the operator says something else, then there's a process in place that, from an agency perspective, could help resolve that. You don't find that in an illegal market. Now, it will take time to shift the people that are comfortable in an illegal environment. You know, they may be offered credit to play. They may be using credit cards, and it's pretty competitive pricing. So it may take some time, but I think, as your listener indicated, there is comfort knowing that your funds would be protected.
Thank you so much, Professor Jennifer Roberts, University of Nevada, Las Vegas, Steve Stallings, California Nation's Indian Gaming Association, and University of North Dakota Professor Stephen Andrew Light, who co-directs UND's Institute for the Study of Tribal Gaming Law and Policy. We'll continue to follow the legislation, which might put on the California ballot legalization of sports gambling. Much more to come in the second hour. Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. So good to have you with us today. Hope your day's going particularly well. Later this hour, we'll take a look at the recently concluded U.S. Supreme Court term. What did we learn about how the justices relate to each other in their rulings, and about the conservative majority of the court? What sorts of differences do we see in their judicial theories as they've played out? And what can we glean that might be a little bit predictive of what's coming with the big cases next term? And then I really want to get you cued into this. If you're someone like me who grew up in Southern California or elsewhere in the country in the 1970s, and you were a student who was at a school where there was court-ordered desegregation through busing, I want to hear about your experiences to that. Strangely enough, this issue, which is, long since ceased to be an issue, came up during the second of the two Democratic candidates' debates last week when Senator Kamala Harris and former VP Joe Biden went back and forth about court-ordered busing, and Senator Harris talking about the advantages that she received through Berkeley's, that was a voluntary program actually in Berkeley that as a student she was able to take advantage of. But it's a very nuanced issue, and certainly pros and cons that are embedded in the court-ordered busing of the 1970s. So if you were someone like me who attended a school that was significantly changed as a result of court-ordered desegregation through busing, I want to hear your story a little bit later this hour. But we begin with a story that goes back a decade ago, 2009. L.A. County Sheriff's deputies had a court order to wiretap a suspect. And they heard as a part of that an alleged conversation involving a narcotics officer, Carlos Arellano, that indicated that he was allegedly involved in drug trafficking. Now, Officer Arellano was not the target of the wiretap. This was an inadvertent interception. So the sheriff's department attempted to discipline Officer Arellano as a part of this, but they suffered setback after setback in court because it was concluded that Arellano was not subject to the wiretap. You couldn't use what was obtained as a part of that to take action against him. But a new bill in Sacramento by Democratic State Senator Tom Umberg of Santa Ana would allow the usage of some intercepted phone calls, emails, other electronic communications where the person is not the intended target of that warrant to wiretap. We're very pleased to have with us State Senator Umberg. Thank you, sir, for joining us today.
Well, thank you, Larry. I appreciate the opportunity to be with you.
So let's talk about to what sort of uses this could be put. Could it allow expanded prosecutions in certain criminal cases where people are inadvertently picked up on a wiretap?
Well, what it would allow is after a court-authorized wiretap, if information in the context of that wiretap is collected concerning other offenses, other serious offenses, and we have a list of 16 very serious offenses, that evidence could be used in another prosecution or, as you mentioned, in a disciplinary proceeding. So, for example, if a prosecutor with affidavits demonstrating probable cause went to a judge and the judge authorized a wiretap, for example, for something like a bombing. And in the course of that wiretap, they collected information concerning a conspiracy to kidnap someone. Then they could use that information, they could use that evidence in a prosecution for the kidnapping.
And are there other states that allow that broader form of prosecution from alleged criminal activity that's inadvertently picked up in a wiretap?
Mm-hmm. I'm not sure about other states, but certainly, for example, under federal wiretap law, you could use that information.
All right. And does California explicitly ban that, or is it just the way that the law is currently written, it doesn't allow explicitly for prosecution of these other crimes by individuals not specifically targeted in the warrant?
Well, it's not just for the individuals not targeted. It's also for individuals that are targeted, but if they're not targeted for those specific crimes. And it doesn't allow the prosecutor to introduce that information to evidence.
We're talking with State Senator Tom Umberg, who represents portions of North and Central Orange County. Also with us, USC law professor Jody Armour. Professor, good to have you with us again.
Good to be back with you, Larry.
What are your concerns about this bill and the broadening of the ability to prosecute under these wiretapping warrants or to do administrative hearings as a result of information gleaned?
Yeah, well, I think the concern that people on the civil liberty side and those who have a keen interest in privacy rights would have is they would ask, are we taking a sledgehammer rather than a scalpel to a particular problem? If this is a problem of officer misconduct that was acquired and then through some constitutional impediments, prosecution couldn't be brought against him criminally. Should that evidence count against him in disciplinary proceedings for employment purposes? And that's a pretty narrow issue, and we could go in after that, but this bill goes much further than that, and it says that when there are overheard conversations that involve not just the enumerated kinds of crimes or the one that was specified in the authorization that was sought from the judge, but one of these serious enumerated crimes, then we're going to give a lot of deference to the interest in privacy. We're going to when it comes to a lot of crimes like violent felonies, human trafficking, murder, those kinds of crimes, that evidence comes in. But others, we're going to kind of be more reluctant to let come in, even though it's tempting too, because there's serious crimes too. But that's the price we're going to have to pay for privacy, is what's been the balance up until now, and this changes that balance.
Professor, do you think that it would be legally problematic to target a bill like this just for information obtained about a law enforcement officer inadvertently as a part of a warrant like this? Could that be more vulnerable to legal challenge because it carves out a specific field, a specific type of job?
Yeah, I think that's spot on, Larry, and that's one of the difficulties here. In the bill itself, in Section 629.82(d)(1), it says if a peace officer intercepts communications relating to crimes other than those specified in, among serious and involving the employment of a peace officer, the contents may not be disclosed except in an administrative hearing or disciplinary hearing involving the employment of the officer. So there already is a carve out like that in the bill. I think it would be a good thing to make that the thrust of the legislation, and at least from a civil liberty standpoint, the rest of it that just extends the number of crimes that can be incriminated if there's overheard evidence about them to serious crimes generally rather than the narrowly enumerated ones.
Talking with USC law professor Jody Armour, also with us Democratic State Senator Tom Umberg of Orange County, as well as portions of Long Beach. I'd like to hear from you what you think about this bill, which would expand the ability to prosecute on charges beyond those that are specifically being considered when a warrant is issued by a judge for law enforcement to wiretap. This would enable information gleaned from the wiretap about other potential crimes or about other individuals who are party to those conversations where prosecutions could occur, or if a law enforcement officer is inadvertently heard to allegedly be involved in criminal activity, that could then be used against him or her in administrative proceedings, disciplinary actions against the law enforcement officer. 866-893-KPCC, 866-893-5722, or the AirTalk page, kpcc.org. Senator Umberg, why did you write the bill in such a way that it includes not just the administrative law enforcement consideration potential, but the broader prosecutorial discretion?
Well, I actually am familiar with wiretaps. One career ago, I was a federal prosecutor, and wiretaps, in terms of protection of civil liberties and as a tool for law enforcement, are closely regulated. You can't just simply willy-nilly tap someone's phone. You need to have probable cause, and you need to have authorization from a bench officer. And so after you've done that for a list of very serious crimes, and I realize serious is a term of art, but you know, crimes that I mentioned earlier, so for example, kidnapping and use of weapons of mass destruction, that kind of thing. So if you have a wiretap, and in the course of monitoring a conversation, somebody in that conversation talks about another serious crime. So, for example, the acquisition of an explosive device, or, you know, for example, a murder. Then you can use that evidence in a prosecution, either the same person or of a different person. Why did I do it? Because I think that this is an important tool, and it's a tool that provides for accuracy. A wiretap, a recorded conversation, is much more accurate than, for example, using a confidential informant to testify as to what he or she may have heard, or using someone who is trying to mitigate their sentence, testify as to something he or she may have heard in that context. The wiretap actually is the actual conversation.
Is there a potential here for law enforcement to game this and use a former federal prosecutor probably have a lot of knowledge about this? Is it easier in some cases for law enforcement to get a warrant for a particular claim, let's say a particular allegation on a suspect, so that law enforcement could game it, get the warrant for something that it's perceived to be easier to get? They're really looking for something else, that it's tougher, perhaps, the threshold for a judge to approve. And so they're strategically asking for one thing and looking for something else. Is that a potential here?
Well, Larry, with any law enforcement tool, if you have people without ethics or honor, it is possible to misuse that tool. The question here is, have we provided the kinds of safeguards to limit that abuse? And indeed, I think we have. If a prosecutor or someone in law enforcement really wanted to game the system, though, they wouldn't use a wiretap. They would use a confidential informant. They would use someone who's working off or trying to mitigate their sentence. It's much easier, number one. And number two, it's to find those folks. And number two, it's much easier to manipulate that if you've got an unscrupulous prosecutor. You don't have to get a warrant for that kind of activity.
Professor Armour, you have any concerns about gaming in that way I described?
Well, human nature is what it is, Larry, and unfortunately we find in all human endeavors there are people who are driven sometimes by perverse incentives to have high arrest rates or conviction rates and the like. And that's not to say that there aren't a lot of very honorable people who try to do everything they ethically can in discharging their roles, but constitutional protections are there to protect us even if we assume that there are good people in office, right? The idea of a constitutional protection is I don't have to depend on your attitude on any given day. This is a right I have.
I want to thank you both for being with us to talk about the bill by Democratic State Senator Tom Umberg of North and Central Orange County. His bill would enable the prosecution of individuals not explicitly targeted in a wiretapping that's authorized by a court, or for other criminal charges to come out of that other than what was being investigated as a part of the granting of the warrant for a wiretap. Jody Armour, USC law professor, with us as well. As we continue on Air Talk, we'll take a look at the recently concluded U.S. Supreme Court term, what we learned about the justices, particularly among the conservative majority. What sorts of differences in legal interpretation are we seeing, and what might that telegraph about some of the big cases that are coming in the next term? You're listening to Air Talk on KPCC. Back in just a minute. Terrific to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Coming up in our next segment after this one, we open up the phones to hear from Those of you that attended schools where mandatory desegregation happened in the 1970s, I was part of the second class at Crozier Junior High School in Inglewood that was subject to court-ordered desegregation as part of the Inglewood School District. And very vivid memories of what that experience was like. And I'd like to hear yours. If you were a student who was bused, if you attended a school where busing had a big impact, what were the effects of that, positively, negatively, just interestingly, that came from that experience? This has come up as a part of the Democratic presidential race with Senator Kamala Harris and former VP Joe Biden going back and forth over their impressions of court-ordered desegregation through busing. That's a little bit later this hour. But right now, we turn our attention to the U.S. Supreme Court and its recently concluded term. The question was, with the departure of Justice Anthony Kennedy, who would be the swing vote? What would be any of the potential fissures or differences between the conservatives who were on the court, which make up the majority now? And joining us to talk about what we've seen and what we potential glean relevant to the next term is Amy Howe, the co-founder of SCOTUS blog and the author of the blog Howe on the Court. Amy, good to have you with us again.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So, were there any surprises for you, in particularly among the conservative wing of the court, how they differentiated themselves?
It was, I think, one of the biggest surprises. I don't know if it was a surprise, but just sort of a reminder that, you know, not all conservative justices are created equal. You don't sort of go online and order a conservative justice. And in particular, Justice Brett Kavanaugh, the court's newest justice, and Justice Neil Gorsuch, you know, they were both appointed by the same president. They're roughly the same age. They even attended the same all-male Catholic high school. But they didn't always vote the same. They only agreed. Justice Kavanaugh actually was in the majority the most of any justice on the Supreme Court. He was in the majority 91%. He only agreed with Justice Gorsuch at the same rate that he agreed with Justice Stephen Breyer and Justice Elena Kagan, who we think of as part of the court's more liberal bloc. So, you know, that was a little bit of a, I don't know if it was a surprise, but it's certainly interesting to watch and a reminder that you can't always predict the way people are going to vote. Justice Gorsuch, you know, on the other hand, was all of the court's more conservative justices sort of crossed over to vote with the four liberals in 5-4 cases. Those are the ones in which the court is the most closely divided. They're often the cases that we, the reporters and the public care the most about. And Justice Gorsuch was actually the one, the conservative justice, who did it the most with four different cases in which he crossed over.
We're talking with Amy Howe, co-founder of SCOTUS blog. My apologies about the dropouts on her audio. We'll try and get that corrected right now. Also with us, Wall Street Journal Supreme Court correspondent Jess Braven. Jess, good to have you back with us. Let's talk a little bit about the role of the Chief Justice and what role is he assuming with the new composition of the court?
Well, Chief Justice Roberts has, I'd say, two principal concerns that we've seen over the years. One is he is a very conservative lawyer, and he has beliefs that have developed over decades in the right way to look at the law, and they tend to go strongly to the right. He's very pro-business. He tends to be sympathetic to prosecutors, all of the hallmarks we would have of a conservative justice. On the other hand, he also has a very deep concern for the institutional credibility of the court and the place of the Supreme Court within the larger government framework. And he knows, as a lawyer who's argued both sides of cases and has experience in different branches of government, that you have to have some credibility from the people on the other side, people who disagree with you, and that the decisions, if they all seem to be extremely aggressive moves to implement a particular ideology, that diminishes the acceptance of the court and the respect for the court and its credibility among people who may not agree with those decisions yet have strong reasons of their own. So we saw, I would say, most dramatically at the last moment of the midterm when the Chief Justice, joined by those liberal members, blocked President Trump from proceeding with a citizenship question on the census form, calling out the administration for what he said were apparently contrived reasons presented to the lower courts for putting that question there. So I'd say that we saw both of those strands present for the Chief Justice as he tries to steer the court to the right, but do so in a way that makes it seem like this is a legal institution and not just another branch of the political infighting in Washington.
Seemed like in the most controversial cases that the liberal bloc hung together. Is that historically consistent, that liberals tend to be more of a bloc on the court, more reliable in terms of their interpretation of the Constitution on it than conservative justices?
Well, since pretty much 1971 or so, the liberals have been the minority on the Supreme Court ever since President Nixon put four appointees on the court just a couple years within the retirement of Chief Justice Earl Warren. So they have a lot of experience in dissenting and in trying to mitigate what they view as wrongheaded directions by a moderate to conservative and now strongly conservative majority. So when what you're trying to do is really stop the majority from taking the court in the wrong direction, as opposed to initiate new interpretations of the law or expand approaches to the law as new cases come up in line with your philosophy, maybe it's not that surprising that they're most cohesive when they're dissenting or when they can persuade one of the conservatives to join them in a view. If a conservative is going to, crossover makes it seem very partisan. I don't know if that's exactly the right model, but to get someone who typically disagrees with them to join their view of things, such as they used to do with Justice Anthony Kennedy in death penalty cases or in gay rights cases, they're not going to want to rock the boat. I mean, they're going to want to agree to everything that justice might want, because the shakiest member of the majority coalition is the one who's going to get his way for fear of losing that vote. So I don't know that it is naturally because they are liberal as opposed to conservative. I think it may
be minority status
that they're in the minority.
Yeah. So that's interesting. You think if the conservatives were in the minority, they would be consistent and essentially their decisions would be as a block.
That may be, although just to undercut my own thesis, when the court found a constitutional basis for same-sex marriage, there were four different dissents by each of the four conservatives who disagreed with the single majority opinion by Justice Kennedy. So, maybe it has to do with these individuals and how they look at things. So I guess the thing is, and Amy has access to all those great statistics that appear on SCOTUS blog, there's a lot of empirical analysis of what the Supreme Court does, but the sample is so small. We're talking about such a tiny handful of people over such a long period of years that it's not the same thing as looking at, broad statistics involving even the Congress, much less any other social trends.
Yeah, an excellent point you make. We're talking with Jess Braven, Wall Street Journal Supreme Court correspondent. Also, the co-founder of SCOTUS blog, Amy Howe, is with us, also writes the blog Howe on the Court. If you have questions for them about the U.S. Supreme Court term recently concluded, as well as the big cases the court has already agreed to take on in the coming term this fall, we're at 866-893-KPCC, 866-893-5722. There's also the AirTalk page at kpcc.org. Amy Howe, do you feel like after this term, all the decisions that have been issued, that you have a clearer sense of where the justices might go for the next term?
It's hard to say. I mean, there was a real sense this term that the justices were trying to avoid conflict as much as they can, whether it was because of the contentious confirmation hearings for Justice Kavanaugh. There's a saying, I think, attributed to Justice Byron White, that every time that the court gets a new justice, it's like a different court. So the idea that they're still kind of getting their footing with the new lineup on the court, it really changes the dynamic. And so, you know, if you look closely at a lot of the high-profile cases that they decided this term, when you're talking about partisan gerrymandering, the census case, those are really cases that they were more or less kind of boxed into taking. The Supreme Court has extraordinary discretion over the cases that it decides to hear, except when it comes to redistricting cases. And so partisan gerrymandering, they didn't have a lot of options. The redistricting cases have an automatic right to appeal to the Supreme Court. The census case, of course, they could have turned it down, but it would have been really unusual to allow a lower court ruling to stand saying that the government couldn't include this question on the census. I think they felt like they had to weigh in on it. You know, on the other hand, they turned down a lot of high-profile issues, or sort of disposed of them in a rather summary way. So I think we're going to get a much better sense of what this new version of the Roberts Court looks like next term, when they take on DACA, when they take on, you know, whether or not federal employment protections that apply to LGBT employees, potentially gun rights cases. It's going to be an interesting term, and it's all going to happen in the context of the presidential election. So there'll be a focus, I think, on the Supreme Court as an institution, and the significance of the lineup of the court as potentially a factor in the presidential election.
It gives us so many great cases to talk about on the program. So I'm looking forward to debating these important cases coming before the U.S. Supreme Court. In case you just tuned in, we're discussing the recently concluded term of the Supreme Court and looking ahead to the next one beginning in the fall. Also looking at what we're learning about the justices themselves and the ways that they came down on these important decisions. Justice Elena Kagan seems to be raising her profile with this most recent term. And Amy Howe, I wonder if you could speak to that, because, of course, Justice Ginsburg has had such a prominent role in writing even dissenting opinions that have been, you know, very pointed. And it seems like Justice Kagan did that this term.
That's right. I think probably the dissenting opinion that we're all going to remember from this term is Justice Kagan's dissenting opinion in the partisan gerrymandering case. It's considered sort of a statement to read your dissenting opinion from the bench. It signals that you're really unhappy with how the case turned out. And it's something that's only done a couple of times each term. And Justice Kagan in particular is not someone who does it lightly. The tradition at the Supreme Court is that the senior justice in the majority or the dissent gets to assign the opinion or the dissenting opinion. And so Justice Kagan's dissenting opinion in the partisan gerrymandering case is something that Justice Ginsburg would have assigned to her. But you know, she's really, you know, one of the most compelling, if not the most compelling, writers on the Supreme Court. So I don't think that it's a coincidence that Justice Ginsburg assigned this really high profile dissenting opinion to her. And she read it from the bench. And, you know, we don't think of Justice Kagan as a particularly passionate person in the way that we think of, you know, some of the other justices. But, and I wasn't in the courtroom, but reporters who were there say that she spoke towards the end, you know, that she, you know, almost seemed as if she were close to tears in reading her dissent from the bench. And there's a really unusual line at the end when she said, you know, with respect and sadness, you know, I dissent from the decision. So certainly we have seen her, you know, before, but this was really one of the highest profile dissents that she's had so far.
Amy and Jess, thank you both for being with us. We appreciate it very much. Talking about the Supreme Court, Amy Howe of SCOTUS Blog and Howe on the Court, Jess Braven, Wall Street Journal Supreme Court correspondent. Coming right up after our update, we're going to open the phones to hear from listeners who, like me, went to a public school where there was court-ordered desegregation through busing. quite a few of us here in Southern California, but also other parts of the country. That court order to desegregate hit a number of urban areas, and it enabled students who otherwise wouldn't have had opportunities for a wider array of classes and stronger teachers and better facilities to attend those schools. But there were definitely trade-offs. This is not just a clear-cut, all is great or all was terrible issue. I want to hear the nuances from you as someone who experienced that court-ordered desegregation through busing. We're at 866-893-KPCC or the Air Talk page, kpcc.org. Back after a live update from Julie Slater. Wonderful to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Fresh Air with Terry Gross, of course, coming up at noon. And on Fresh Air, the untold story of the Chernobyl nuclear disaster. Journalist Adam Higginbotham, author of Midnight in Chernobyl, talks about the design flaws, the shortcuts, the Soviet secrecy, lack of imagination that led to the 1986 disaster. That's Fresh Air coming up at noon here on KPCC. Well, let's go back even further than Chernobyl, about 50 years ago, when federal courts issued decisions which mandated desegregations in a number of school districts across the United States and mandating that busing be the way of attempting to provide more of a racial and ethnic balance at schools. The LA Unified School District was a district that was ordered by the court to undergo desegregation. The Pasadena Unified School District, another. The Englewood School District, where I was a student in the late 60s, early 70s. I started at Crozier Junior High School in downtown Englewood just a year after mandatory busing significantly changed the racial composition of Crozier. The school that I attended was pretty much 50% African American, 50% white students. And it brought a tremendous change to that school. And this issue of court-ordered busing came up, oddly enough, it was 50 years old we're talking about, but it was a central issue of last Thursday's Democratic presidential candidates debate in a back-and-forth between California U.S. Senator Kamala Harris and Joe Biden, the former VP. And she went after him for being opposed to court-ordered mandatory busing. He defended his decision of not backing court-ordered mandatory busing. And she talked about all the benefits that she'd gotten as a student because of Berkeley's voluntary busing program, where she'd been exposed to things, been able to have access that she simply wouldn't have had before that. And I've seen over the years, I've talked with a lot of people who said, yeah, it was worth the hour-long bus ride from South Los Angeles to the San Fernando Valley to go to a school that had higher quality teachers, that had more courses available to me, that had a more rigorous academic program than I would have had, better facilities than I would have had. I've heard from a lot of listeners who hold that view. But there were also distinct trade-offs that came from it. And Howard Bloom, a Los Angeles Times education reporter, recently wrote about this. And Howard, I understand you've gotten quite a bit of response to your piece.
Well, yes, I have. And it's really all over the map. There are people who look back nostalgically on that era as something of value. And there are people who remember the city being torn apart by busing. And you know, it was something that people lived through. And so everybody's perspectives, including your own, I guess, in Englewood, is completely legitimate and is a piece of this. Of course, I was a student in North Carolina, and it was a period of integration there as well. But
yeah. Yeah. And it is so individualized. You know, for me, some of the things that I remember, you know, I liked attending a highly diverse school. There were tensions that came with that, of course. And, you know, I think you could argue that the tensions were worth it for the diversity. But Englewood is a city that was really ripped apart by this. And there was tremendous white flight that occurred. And, you know, you could go on almost endlessly debating, did the pros outweigh the cons or vice versa? I guess one of the things that bothers me a little bit, Howard, is I feel like sort of this has taken on a proxy status. It's almost become more symbolic than what the much more nuanced, much more complex results were of mandatory busing.
Right. And also, most students never truly experienced the diversity that was promised because the mandatory busing was just getting started in L.A. And for the most part, L.A. has had voluntary busing. And while some students, it has changed their experience of school and their lives, most students, in fact, did not participate in the integration program at all. And, of course, there was substantial white flight, people going to private schools, people moving out of the L.A. Unified School District. So, I mean, we still have a legacy. We have the magnet program today, which people forget was an integration program. But that's one legacy that lives on to this day. But ironically, most of the students in that magnet program are minorities. There are just not that many white students to go around these days in the LA Unified School District.
Well, I want to hear those individual perceptions, those stories. Again, if you're someone who was going to school during that period of the early 70s when there was court-ordered mandatory busing for desegregation purposes, what were your perceptions of it? How did it change, in your view, your educational experience, social experience? What effect did it have on your community? 866-893-KPCC. Heather, in Pasadena, what was your experience of this?
Yes. In the early 70s, we lived in Woodland Hills, and they opened Woodland Hills to busing from Watts. And when they did, there was a bunch of fights at the school that I never remembered the year before. And then the next year, I was supposed to be bused to Watts, which would have meant a three-hour-a-day round-trip bus trip for me and my brother. And my parents packed up, and we moved to Valencia.
And I think that experience, you know, was duplicated over and over again. Because I don't know, and Howard, do we have any statistics how many white students actually went through the process of being bused to schools in African American communities?
It's a pretty small number, because what happened is that just as the district was on the verge of doing a massive involuntary busing program, the legal landscape changed. So there's a little bit of that happened, but for the most part, it pretty much never happened. But what did happen was the minority students were bused to the white schools as part of just it wasn't even a magnet school. It was just called permits with transportation. And that started in the early 70s. And so it isn't so much the experience of white students going to minority neighborhoods that happened. It's really more the experience of minority students going to schools in the Valley or on the West Side. That's actually was the more common experience.
My memory of Englewood, and I'm certainly open to being corrected by people who might have information that contradicts this, but my memory of what happened was that significant numbers of African-American students from Morningside Park area of Englewood were bused into Englewood High School and to Crozier instead of going to Monroe Junior High School or Morningside High School. But you didn't have anywhere near comparable numbers of white students who allowed to be bused into the Morningside Park area. So you had then a big drop in the enrolled population at Morningside and at Monroe, and you had an increasing student population at Englewood High and at Crozier with a pretty much 50-50 mix of white and black students. But with white flight, you had an overall decrease in the student population. That's my memory as a kid, as, you know, a 12, 13-year-old going to school in Englewood at the time. And so it was a mixed bag. 866-893-KPCC or the AirTalk page, kpcc.org. We'll continue our conversation with Joseph in El Sereno, Dana in West Covina, Sandra in Westwood. Again, I want to hear from you. I particularly want to hear from African-American students who went through the busing era. We heard from Senator Kamala Harris, who talked about what she thought were the tremendous advantages, the opportunities she was able to have as a student in Berkeley that she wouldn't have had without busing. Now, in Berkeley, it was voluntary, but nonetheless, I want to hear your experiences. 866-893-KPCC. Back in a minute. find it so interesting that an issue that was incredibly controversial 50 years ago came up and became a focal point of Thursday's Democratic candidates debate between Senator Kamala Harris and former Vice President Joe Biden, the issue mandatory school desegregation through court-ordered busing. But I'm less interested in what you think sort of politically of that. I'm interested in your personal experience. If you went through that in the early 1970s, we're at 866-893-KPECC. Let's talk with Joseph in El Sereno. Joseph, you went through this, that right?
I did, and it was, as far as schooling, the worst experience of my life. I'm 62 years old, and I could still remember it like if it was yesterday. All this did was take gangs from opposing neighborhoods and cram them all into one school, lock them up. So during lunch, there was no lunch. It was a gang fight. After school, you would have squad cars lined up at the front of the school, the helicopter going overhead. By the time I would make it out of school, there would be 40 kids face down with hands zip ties. This added no quality at all to any education. It did the opposite. I still recall even teachers being beat up by members of opposing neighborhood gangs. There was nothing this did to edify or increase education. It quite did the opposite. I even remember police at that time saying they really don't recommend this because all it did is what it did. It took opposing gangs, lock them up in one place, and created nothing but chaos.
Now, Joseph, what community did you grow up in?
I grew up in El Sereno, went to El Sereno Elementary, El Sereno Junior High School, and that's where most of this forced integration busing was at the time, El Sereno Junior High School and then Woodrow Wilson High School.
All right. Joseph, thank you for sharing your experience, 866-893-KPECC. Howard Bloom, LA Times education reporter. Did you hear from readers who brought up the gang issue?
A little bit. I mean, of course, one of the principles behind busing is that the idea is that everybody shares the fate of everyone else. And so if the reality of gangs and poor quality education and hardship is true in one school, the theory is that if everybody has to share some elements of that fate, it will become unacceptable and that schools will improve for all. So but obviously trying that out in the real world is a little bit more complicated than that.
All right. Let's talk with Robin in Culver City. Robin, what was your experience of this?
Well, I grew up in West Los Angeles in the late 60s and early 70s. And in the 60s, an African-American girl was bused to my school on the Permit with Transportation program. She became one of my very best friends. And then soon after in junior high school, a junior high in LA Unified had been closed, and the largely African-American students were bused to the West L.A. school where I was attending, and a different African-American girl became another close friend of mine. So these are people I never would have met as an Anglo if it hadn't been for these programs.
Yeah. Robin, I appreciate it so much. 866-893-KPECC. John in Fontana. John, you went to Bell High School, is that right?
Yes, I did. 1971, 2, and 3. During that time, it was more we volunteered to go to Bell on a transfer, although Fremont High School was my home school. Well, by attending Bell, I had privileges that I never had in the black neighborhood. Not only that, we never had any tension between blacks and white at Bell High. We all got along well, even to this day. There's friends I've been knowing for 50 years.
What a great story. That's true. How many African-American kids would you guess were going to Bell along with you?
In 1971, I'm going to say at the most, it was 15 blacks in the entire school.
Wow.
72 more came, and 73, there was even more. And all the blacks to this point, not a one had an issue at that time.
And there were friendships that were made across racial lines freely?
Yes, even to this day.
That's great. Hey, John, thank you for sharing that. 866-893-KPCC, our Air Talk page, kpcc.org. Also with us, LA Times education reporter Howard Bloom is a frequent guest with us. He wrote a terrific piece recently about court-ordered mandatory busing desegregation in the LA Unified School District. But it wasn't just LA. There were other districts as well, like Pasadena and Inglewood, where this happened. Now, Anne, in Altadena, you were a Pasadena high school student when this happened?
Yes, I was. And it was a terrible experience for all the kids who started at Pasadena High School, left to go to Muir, and the kids who started at Muir and were bused to Pasadena High School. Pasadena Unified screwed it up so badly because they did not do anything voluntarily to integrate our schools. They were forced to, with the federal mandate, to bus kids. And it was a mess. We had riots, trash cans burned. We had to close the schools several days because of the riots at Pasadena High School. So it was a terrible experience for me. And then there was a huge white flight out of Pasadena Unified Schools after that. And I don't think Pasadena Unified has ever recovered. They just screwed it up to begin with, and they're still doing the same thing.
Anne, thank you for your call. Now, Lisa in Pasadena was also a student who was bused at that time. So, Lisa, what was your experience of it? Did you see it differently?
I didn't hear all of the previous caller, but I did see it differently. It was a positive experience for me. I was bused from my home in Northwest Pasadena to McKinley Junior High School, which was a really positive thing for me. I had actually been afraid at the thought of going to junior high school at the neighborhood high school.
And
my siblings had been there.
Oh, okay. So you had siblings that had gone, so you had the chance to go to McKinley. And were there programs or the environment of the school? What are the things that were better than you think would have been going to your neighborhood junior high?
I think I was getting a good education at my neighborhood school, and we had Girl Scouts before and we had Girl Scouts after. It was mainly meeting different people and then being exposed to other parts of Pasadena that I didn't know existed. I didn't know what a Trader Joe's was before busing, for example.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I learned about other resources and just other parts of the city that I didn't know.
Lisa, appreciate your call. And Will in El Segundo said, I was bused in the seventh grade to Porter and then to Byrd Junior High in Sun Valley. I'm a mix of Latin and African descent from Central America, but I look African-American, Will said. I got a great mix of perspectives, and it made me more well-rounded. That's Will in El Segundo. Howard Bloom, thank you so much for coming on and talking about this and related to your piece that, of course, is at latimes.com. Always a pleasure.
Great topic, Larry.
Thanks so much. Howard Bloom, education reporter for the Los Angeles Times. Fresh Air is coming up next here on 89.3. And also, if you are a former student who was exposed to mandatory court-ordered busing in the early 70s, please share your experiences on the AirTalk page. It keeps going, kpcc.org.